I want to thank everyone for coming to the Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder Symposium. I have sent two men that I love very deeply to war, and now my son. I started learning about PTSD because obviously someone I love had all the signs. When I went to Japan, the Pentagon Channel had a program on PTSD, and David Powell, who had PTSD for years, had written a book to help others. When I got back to the USA, I found the book, and for a loved one, it hits you to the core, that if the person that you love and care about is going through all these emotions. I shared this book with other loved ones and some Vietnam vets and a service member that served in Iraq 2 years ago and is recovering. I even mailed a book to the person I care about, though I'm sure that copy has gone unread. They all read it and said, wow, it touched them. The vet said to me, this is what your friend is going through. I picked up the phone to Victor and asked, does David do any personal appearances? My blonde moment. I thought, hey, if David could talk to Task Force Sabre and other Vermont Guardsmen and their loved ones and troops, they would realize that they are not alone, and hopefully they would understand that they are not alone. I was told yes for a ticket and a hotel and done, and that I will be forever grateful for because I don't think I could have done it otherwise. It has been so overwhelming going around our state and finding out what a need there is. The stories from veterans and loved ones. My hope today is that I hope the troops will be touched and get the help that they need and find the strength to ask for help. Family members, loved ones, friends, seek out support. Do whatever you have to do to get the help to the people you love and care about. A counselor told me that there was no wrong in this. You just plug along and try so very hard to do whatever you can to support them and find out what works. Even in God, and this is a big even, if it means subjecting yourself to pain. I know what it feels like to be shut out. Soldiers, if people you love are telling you to go get help, listen. The one thing I learned from soldiers themselves and talking to them about Ramadi, that it was a hellhole, as I'm sure all of Iraq is. Service members have told their wives, girlfriends, families, and friends to go to hell. They want to be left alone, that we don't understand. Some have lost everything. The greatest gift that you can give to a returning soldier is your love and time. It is the hardest thing that you will ever do, and crying helps a lot. I would like to leave you with something my mom wrote. She sent it to her three kids before her last surgery and death. If we listen to the words, it is so true. Though time may take away many things from us, it cannot change the fact that we have loved and been loved. Love is all that really lasts. Whatever we may achieve in life will be continually reevaluated. Whatever we may accumulate in life, time will erase. All that lasts is the love that we share with others. I hope and pray this is a time for healing, and thank you all for coming. And let me introduce you to the man, David Powell.
Thank you. David Powell. My mother made that up, and I keep it. I'm happy to be here. If I touch one of you who touches another and gets somebody some help, I win. Thanks again for having me. Nobody here would be in this room if it weren't for Lisa Silk. 100% contribution, including transportation and a lovely room at the Wyndham, out of her pocket. God bless her, and join me in thanking her. Thank you, Lisa. I'm not a great public speaker, so I'm going to be referring to my outline here and trying to animate it as much and just speak from my heart. Bear with me if I don't hold your glaze. I'm not a psychiatrist, a psychologist, a therapist, social worker. I'm a high school graduate. I am also a combat experienced Vietnam veteran. I served in the infantry in Vietnam in 1966 and 1967. My full active duty enlistment was 2 years, 13 months of which was spent in Vietnam. So I didn't get much military active duty experience on the States. It was 6 months in, 6 months back. I'm a permanently wounded post-traumatic stress disorder casualty. I know it firsthand. I know the things that happened to me and the resulting 2 decades of suffering because I ignored it and didn't seek help. I wrote my memoir so that people who I don't meet might read it and understand that our Iraqi and Afghanistan boys and girls are coming back psychologically and physically wounded. Walter Reed and company takes care of the physical part heretofore excellently. I can't speak to the news of today. But they all have some form of psychological trauma. And I hope through my memoir that it gives them the impetus to just talk to somebody and get it out. If it stays inside, it's going to fester and burn, and it's going to become an ulcer. I've had them. I'm not just a participant in the Vietnam War. My MOS was 0351, which signified that my military occupational specialty was anti-tank assault. When I was first given that title, if you will, I found it quite amusing because I didn't know that any Vietnamese drove tanks. The people I said that to didn't find that to be very amusing. They said, "You're going to come on almost every patrol that goes out, because if we take fire, we're going to have to call in artillery. And in order to do that, you're going to have to shoot a white phosphorus round where they are, and then we can get the map coordinates and shoot them." So that was one of my weapons, the rocket launcher. There was also, later on, a light anti-tank assault weapon, which was plastic and shot a smaller rocket round. I grew very fond of that weapon because I could carry 4 of them and was not dependent on my A-gunner. Also, I could carry my rifle, which I dearly loved. And when I carried the rocket, all I could carry was a .45. And my marksmanship with a .45 was about as good as trying to find a doorbell in the dark. Not so with the rifle. Still hearing me okay? Yeah, good. Most of what I'm going to be talking to you about is post-traumatic stress. I'd like to say that PTSD, which is the acronym for it, is not a prejudicial disorder. You don't have to be in combat. You can be near combat. You can be a spouse at home and get post-traumatic stress. I'll give you some examples of non-combat experiences that will bring that a little more true. Home invasions scares the heck out of you, whether you're home or not. If you come home and it's dark sometime in the future and a noise makes you think that your home is still being invaded, you're going to go right back and relive that experience. That's post-traumatic stress. Robberies, being stuck up, carjacking. We're still not in combat. Car accidents, physical attacks, rape, abuse, both physical and psychological. This is true particularly about 6 fellows that I met just before coming here in the deserts of Tucson, Arizona. They had just returned from Iraq. They said they were in combat, but though they carried a rifle, they never knew where the enemy was. Their mortal fear was IEDs. So they had all the combat stress and nobody to vent it on. That gives truth to the fact that you can have post-traumatic stress by merely witnessing brutality or the maiming of others. I sent all six kids to the VA, and then I said, if you don't get help there, go to the vet center, which is just down the street, and they know everybody at the VA, and you'll get help somehow. As an aside, this is not a political talk. I don't have anybody that I want to beat up on or make wrong. I want to make people well. I don't care what kind of therapy they find, what kind of counseling, whether it be religious, anti-religious, mainstream psychiatry, or just a buddy. Get it out, talk it through, and if you need further help, more professional help, go find it. It is not AIDS. You don't have a fatal disease and the stigma that used to be associated with AIDS. AIDS, four letters. PTSD, four letters. One's physical. If you knew that you had AIDS and there was a way to treat it so that you could live a full and productive life, everyone that was diagnosed with AIDS would go get help. I say the same is true for the next four letters, PTSD. If you know you've got it, or think you've got it, or your friends got it, why not go get help so you can live a productive life? That's for me to ask and you to answer. I submit you should go. Another form of non-combat PTSD is public humiliation. Stand up and say, I support the veterans in Iraq. And somebody says, you're an asshole. Well, that's embarrassing. And you may not stand up and say it again. But you're going to remember the time they attacked you. And that's a form of trauma. I'd like to talk a little bit about like recognizing PTSD. There's some book stuff, some clinical stuff that can help to set the diagnosis for post-traumatic stress. The symptoms are relatively few, and I'm going to read them so I don't skip them. You may feel overwhelmed and helpless. That is a symptom of post-traumatic stress. Yes, sir.
Extra mic.
Oh, thank you. Hello, thank you. Sorry about the. Another one. And I was talking to one of the guests today about this, explaining it in my own way. Persistent re-experiencing. And I told the lovely girl that I was speaking with, I said, a traumatic stressor can be difficult to experience psychologically, but then it may fade away. And as it fades away, it becomes a memory, such as how to get to the local Walmart. You get in the car and you go down three blocks and turn right, and then it's open from 9 to 9. That's a memory. Re-experiencing means something triggers a recall of that traumatic stressor, and you're there. At the same time it happened to you mentally, you're smelling the same things, it's the same time of day, your heart is beating just as fast, and the here and now is not even interesting, because you're stuck back in your traumatic stressor. When I say that, it's not such a subtle difference, but if you ever do re-experience a trauma, you'll know exactly what I mean. One of the other symptoms, which is kind of easy to see in some of the new kids coming back, avoiding experiences or people that trigger or help you remember what happened to you back there that you don't want to talk about. The clinical word for nervousness, I call it startle reaction. Jumpiness, sudden noise and you freak when everyone else goes, what was that? And you're on the floor. An easy one to pick up, and I spoke to another gentleman, difficulty sleeping, gentleman who is here today. Night sweats, nightmares. In addition to being terrified of going to sleep, I would have daymares, I call them, where just sitting quietly by myself, I'd be musing, and something would remind me about something I did in Vietnam. And all current activity would stop until that film finished running. Then I could go back into reality. That was a daymare. You can see this. Lisa and I talked about this with respect to her friend. Sudden bouts of rage. There is no gradation from anger to full-blown rage in a PTSD sufferer. By a gradation, I mean that they start raising their voice and they get a little more upset and a little more agitated and moving around. Finally, then they're really mad and they're pounding the table. Post-traumatic stress disorder casualty will go from calm to full-blown rage. Opposite reaction. They'll be absolutely fine, maybe euphoric, and go into a deep depression just as fast and with no steps up or down. Another one that, if you think about it, you've probably seen it, and that's when the casualty is nowhere to be found. They are practicing isolation to include all the blinds drawn, shutters closed, door locked, lights out. No, I'm not here. And you know they're sitting in the front room thinking about stuff. Get a little personal to, not to make it lighthearted, but to make sure that you understand that this isn't textbook stuff. This is just David. Thanks for bearing with me. That'll happen. I came back, like I said, in 1967. I was 26 when I came back. My military tour was as an adult, not as a teenager. So I think I had a greater act of memorization. What happened to me, I memorized. It wasn't just something that skipped away like kids can do. I thought I was a monster. Thinking that and remembering that 1968, 69, 70, and so on was very anti-Vietnam. 68, I think, was the worst year because it was the was my first year back, so I'll say it was the worst year. What that told me was that it was dangerous to have been a veteran. God forbid they found out I was a combat veteran. Worse yet, to find out what I had done. So, instead of talking about it, answering superfluous questions that really didn't expect answers. David, how was it over there? And then, what are we going to do this afternoon, or are you hungry? You know, there was no real curiosity. I began hiding my experiences. When I was asked where I was, and I was living in Southern California, I'd say I was up in San Francisco for a little over a year, and then I relocated back home. If I was in San Francisco, I would say I was in Long Beach or Pasadena. on a sabbatical. God forbid they'd find out. I had post-traumatic stress and I didn't know it. Neither did the American Psychiatric Association, the Veterans Administration, civilians or government entities, people of faith. They used to call it, oh gosh, it goes back to since fighting wars began, post-traumatic stress has been in existence. Just to take some names from history, in the Civil War, the kids that were hurt psychologically were acting like they were homesick. So we'll just say that's homesickness. Then we had World War I. And, well, apparently, these kids that are acting weird now that they're back probably have shell shock. So we'll say shell shock is what their psychological problem is. Maybe the exploding bullets or something. But they're sure different than when they left. Then you've got World War II. And the poor babies coming home from that. Babies is anyone younger than me, and I'm 65. So they came back with battle fatigue. That was the label. And then that didn't seem to fit because there was a lot of non-combats that were still acting strange and out of the norm. They weren't the person that went. So let's call it war neuroses, and we'll just leave it at that. And we'll try psychology and just they'll get over it. The war's over. They're back home. They're not dead, so they're fine. Well, that didn't work for Vietnam. Finally, enough people got sick of those titles, and outside of the Veterans Administration, disabled American veterans, veterans of foreign wars, American Legion, they all got together and said, these guys are coming around and they're hurting, but there's nothing for them to turn to. The VA doesn't have anything. This American Psychiatric Association doesn't even know what's wrong with them, but we do as peers know that something's wrong. And that caught the attention of the American Psychiatric Association. And after a lot of academic powwow, in 1980, they came along with the title Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder and a diagnostic and statistics manual was printed, and it said, if you've got these symptoms, and you've got these symptoms, and it's been over 6 months, then you've got PTSD, and we'll work on some solutions to help you. So, reflecting on my own stuff again, 67 to 1980, they didn't even know what to call it. After they gave it a name, they didn't know what to do with it. But for 13 years, there was nowhere for me to turn. And by that time, by 1980, Tanqueray, Smirnoff's, Jack Daniels, Chivas Regal, and anything that was over 80 proof that I could drink was my solution. And it worked. It worked to numb me, but it didn't work to fix me. I'd like to amplify on one of my experiences, and this isn't, pardon me while I take a drink of water. Believe me, this isn't bragging. And as I preface it, I'd hopefully encourage you to remember that I said, witnessed and or did the following in 13 short months. Witnessed and or did the following. Murder, drowning, cowardice, suicide, self-inflicted wounds. An example, being on patrol. Some guy's sick of being on patrol, wants a Purple Heart, wants to go back and maybe get sent to the States. Pulls a pin on his hand grenade, throws it in the bush beside him, turns away. Shrapnel. Self-inflicted wounds. I saw that not daily, but often. Sometimes it goes awry. I saw three guys do it. It's in my memoir. They invited me to come along with the fragging, they called it. And I said, no thanks, and backed away from them. Well, the three of them got together and they threw a hand grenade in front of them. And they covered themselves up. And it went off, and all three got shrapnel. All three got medevaced. And the fellow that dropped the grenade lost his ring finger. And along with his ring finger, he lost his ability to play guitar. Broke his heart. I didn't see him again. He didn't come back. I'm back in Nam. I witnessed rape. Not once, but several times. I saw torture and killing of men, women, children, and animals. In Afghanistan and Iraq, every newscast that I've seen includes IEDs blowing up Humvees or tanks or whatever. The Viet Cong had mines and booby traps also, so our surroundings were dangerous with respect to mines and explosives. I also witnessed arson, which I've got pictures of. We used to burn bills down just to amuse ourselves. A ville was a hamlet where the poor citizens used to live. Mutilation. Men, women, boys, girls, animals. Though I knew it was dangerous to make friends, I made a few. They were younger than me by 5-6 years, but I did make a few. I had them killed in battle. I didn't do it, but they died. When you're in combat, you can depend on your fellow combatants. Everybody's got your back, they say. You do what you need to do, and I'll do what I need to do, and we'll protect each other, mate. High fives, all that. I'd been abandoned 3 times under fire. 3 times. I risked my life countless times. I say countless. They're countable. But I choose not to count them. That's my list. That all had a toll on my sanity. I didn't know how big or how bad, but I knew it before I came home that I was in psychological trouble. There was a thing that they used to do to us veterans that were in the field, and that was to give us a 5 to 7 day break from combat, in my case. And we could go out of the field, go out of country. Included was Hawaii. That was a 7-day R&R. So I waited 6 or 7 months to take my first R&R because I wanted to go to Hawaii. I wanted to go because I was married at the time that I went in, and I was going to rendezvous with my then wife. There's a little more elaboration in the book. I'm not here to sell the book. I'm talking about PTSD. I made it. I got to R&R. Long plane flight. Very quiet. They darkened the cabin because it was like 15, 17-hour flight. Well, when the lights go out, the mind starts running its films, which was true in my case. And I was like daymare, nightmare, not really falling asleep, but recounting some of my experiences. And then I felt the jet start to slow down. And it, as it started to descend, I knew I was going to land and be on R&R. In those days, on Oahu, they land on the tarmac, or where the planes land, not up to a terminal. So they rolled out a stairway that you could walk down, and then 50 meters or 50 yards or so, you could get to the terminal where the passengers would be greeted by the guests that were there to get them. It was night when I landed. And at the bottom of the stairs, you had the choice. You could walk leisurely to the terminal and greet your friends. But remember that less than 24 hours ago, I was in combat, and it was dark. And between the stairway last step to the terminal was wide open spaces. Wide open spaces mean that you're like a black hat on a white sand beach. Everybody's going to see you, and you're a prime target. So I chose to run from the plane to the terminal and through the doors. Got into the terminal, and it was packed with people, even late at night. That was another non-good thing. Wherever two or more are gathered, it's a larger target that draws the attention of the Viet Cong or the sniper or what have you. And that's where the bullets are going to go, the obvious target. So people were dangerous. So I'm trying to keep my space and my distance and try to find my wife at the same time. So I'm looking around. She sees me and comes up behind me, and I don't hear her or see her. She touches my shoulder. I dove to the ground, rolled over three times, and was prone. Everybody there screamed. My wife screamed. I came too. I wasn't being ambushed or shot at. I was in Hawaii, regaining my sanity. So I stood up, brushed myself off, gave her a kiss, and went off to drink myself silly with her, got back on the plane and headed to Nam again, certain of my death, certain. I got there in October of 66. I was shot in the chest on a daylight patrol in December of 66. So in May of 67, when I had my R&R, I knew what I was coming back to, which was my demise. This is an experience I'll relate now. That one told me that there was something psychologically wrong with me. Fear of open spaces, hypervigilance, exaggerated startle response. All this stuff came back in the 80s and the National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder here in Vermont was established in 89 to get the full academic description of post-traumatic stress and treatments and so on. They've done a fine job, but we're back in 67. Well, my parents knew I was screwed up when I got out. But they didn't say... Nobody knew about PTSD, so they didn't know what to do. They couldn't ask me if I needed psychological help. That wasn't in their vocabulary. They just knew that I was different. and they thought I needed to be re-socialized so I could get on with my life and get back to being a data processor and all those good things. As a family, we used to play nine holes of par three golf. That's what my parents chose to take me to do July 4th, 1968. I was released from active duty April 68. July 4th, 68. We're moving up to about the sixth hole. We'd all knocked the golf ball onto the green. And we were all approaching, the three of us, my mom, dad, and I, approaching the green to putt out. I heard 8 or 9 rifle rounds, about as close as from here to the back of the room. And of course I knew they were firing at me. Purple Heart, Black Cat on White Sand Beach. Sure, they're shooting at you. Psychological reaction, self-preservation. I found myself, when I came to, I was in the sand trap. And the putter I had in my hand, the putting part was jammed into my shoulder, and I had the putter ready to fire back. I woke up kind of like that and looked up to my parents. And they were looking at me like this. And when they saw me catch their eye, they went and said nothing, like it didn't happen. Well, the shame that fell on me was amazing. So here I'm trembling and asshole, and I said, well, happy Independence Day. And played out the golf hand. Hypervigilance, startle reaction, survivor. Still didn't know about it. That was 68. 72 came around. Had 2 children by that time. And had sufficiently destroyed the quality of my wife's life that she left me and took the kids. I was the first of several divorces. So 72 was another personal loss. Still nowhere to turn. 1980 comes. 85, 86, 87. Bankruptcy. Just lost my 18th job in 10 years. Maybe $2,000, $2,500 in the savings account to pay first and last and get some dump to go live in while I tried to find another job. I broke down. Nowhere to turn. Not going to go to the VA. Where am I going to go? This is all self-dialogue. I've got nobody to talk to. Nobody's asking me questions. They don't have anything to do with me. That center in the yellow pages or white pages, I forget which. I went there and I talked to a guy. I talked at him. He and I sat in a room and he said, what's wrong? And I went on for about 1 hour and 10 minutes crying, choking, like I'm probably going to do here. And he said, well, thanks for coming in. If you want to come in again and talk, fine. So, no thanks. Went back to, I found another job by that time. And about 3 months had gone by. And this fellow called me up. I'd given him my home phone for some stupid reason. And he said, we're starting a rap group. I'm part of the Veterans Administration, and this is after work, and it's not really medical. It's just Vietnam veterans get together and they chat. And they try to work out their problems. And there's two therapists in the group, so maybe you get something out of it. And I said, well, great, I'll go. There was 11 guys in the group. Three of them had combat experience. The rest didn't. So even then, it wasn't as advertised. But I kept going. We'd go in, we'd do 5 minutes each, how's your week been? And then somebody would be called on and they'd start to discuss something that was traumatic that they were trying to get over, whether it be in Vietnam or in present time. It was exactly an hour and a half. If it ticked, 7:30, that was it. Everybody goes home. See you next Thursday. Which meant that if you had something that you were really stuck in and you wanted to bring it up at the group, you waited until Thursday so you could talk it out, and somebody else got to talk first, and that meter went over till time's over, you didn't get stuck. You were stuck again. Another week goes by, and you hope that you can talk. That went on for 16 months. Once a week, I kept trying to get some help. Didn't happen. The one Thursday that made it my last Thursday was also the time that I got to speak, and I got to speak pretty much right on the beginning. And what I told them was my jump story. And that was an experience that happened to me within the first 2 or 3 weeks of being in Nam. I did, incidentally, 7 months in an area called Chu Lai and 6 months in Da Nang. Da Nang was where the rocket belt was and all that. I'm in Chu Lai. We went on a major operation. At least 500 men or more. I had done about a dozen of those in my tour. My Tour in Hell, name of the book. I had been on numerous platoon and company-sized operations in my tour, and at least 150 patrols and ambushes. This was my first major operation. We were helicopter lifted to the battle site. It was mid-morning. There must have been 16 helicopters. We'd go into the center of the fight. The helicopter would come within 4 feet of the wet rice paddies that were there at the time. This is October, maybe November. They'd drop the tailgate. Everybody in would run out and find the tree lines and set up their perimeter of defense. My turn came, and my helicopter was coming down. I was sitting closest to the pilot. 4 feet, tailgate opens, everybody goes out. Helicopter, while the guys are running, the helicopter right to the right of me goes down under enemy fire, sputters and stops. The pilot and co-pilot abandon. The door gunner gets out and runs. My pilot sees it. I don't own him, but he was driving the thing I was riding in. He saw the other guy go down. Up he goes, and I'm still aboard. I'm the last guy on the helicopter. Thank you very much. And I've got like 3 rocket rounds. I'm an assistant gunner to a fellow named Jones, who has the bazooka. It's a rocket launcher, but it's a bazooka. And he's got 1 round in the bazooka and a .45 and the heat of battle, that's not going to do him a lot of good. So the crew member taps on the pilot and he says, there's another guy on board here. And he's the last one, but he's got to get out there. And I say to myself, I can't leave Jones down there. I'm his assistant gunner. I've got to support him. Well, instead of descending, the pilot hovers and the door stays down. And the crew member, the gunner says, what are you going to do without saying so much? I get out to the end. I'm looking down about 30 feet. Wet rice paddy, Jones and the rest of them. Jones is kind of looking up at me. I dove. I can't leave Jones. That 30 feet took about 15 minutes in my mind. I filmed every single second of it. Scared the feces out of me, to be kind. I started crying while I was telling my group of comrades in Menlo Park, California. And 7:30 came. I'm still crying, trying to catch my breath and finish the story that finishes that. I didn't die, obviously. I didn't break anything, obviously. Could have. But continued on, joined up with Jones, and then we went on the operation and did what we did. That I didn't get to tell the group because it was 7:30. Everybody adjourns. I get in my car, and I live about 15 miles north in a place called Foster City, California. It's 7:35, maybe. It's dark. I'm alone. I'm driving up the freeway. It's a three-lane, one-way. 101, I think it's called. Three lanes each direction. I'm in the left lane driving, and I start running the film because I hadn't finished my story. I'm still in the jump. And I'm in the middle of the free fall when I come to, and I'm on the freeway. I come to because I had hit the right side of the road with my tires. I had drifted clear across all three lanes. I locked my arms. My eyes are bulging. I'm holding my breath, and I do a 360 and come to a stop. Took a couple of short breaths. Looked around to see if I'd hit anyone or anything, which I hadn't. Thank God. Started the car back up and drove in the left lane, the slow lane, home. Thursday night. Got in my apartment, locked it, pulled the blinds, turned off the lights, didn't turn on the TV, and I sat there, returning to Vietnam in my mind from my R&R in Hawaii, clear until Monday morning, when the alarm said, okay, you got to go back to your new job. The next Thursday, I went to the group, and I said, before we start, it's been a pleasure meeting you all. I quit. And I did a 180 and left. Nobody chased me. At that same time, by good fortune and mere chance, met a fellow named Gerald French, who was involved in a non-VA, non-government intellectual pursuit of an activity that would help people who had experienced traumatic stressors, traumatic experiences that needed to be handled, if you will, and that's in quotes. Called the outfit, this organization of people, Traumatic Incident Reduction Association. If you drop the word association, you can come up with traumatic incident reduction, abbreviated like PTSD, TIR. He said, David, I don't know you well. You don't know me well, but I would like to try and help you. I said, thank you, Gerald, but I just spent 16 months at the VA and I'm worse off now. My emotional flooding is about one click below smiling, which I demonstrated for you today, much to my chagrin. He said, what we do is different. And hear me out. Being a non-confrontationalist. I said, sure, Gerald, go ahead. He says, okay. It's one-on-one, me and you. Okay? Nobody else around. I don't know what to do. That sounded better than a group of 11 with two therapists, maybe 13. Please go on. He says, it's non-hypnotic. There's no drugs. There's nothing but me here to listen to what you have to say. And I'm not going to make any judgment nor any remarks about it. And see if it doesn't help you. I said, okay, when do you want to do it? He says, you come back next... come down to my house. It was called the... Institute for Metapsychology, I think it was called. It was in Palo Alto. He said, I've got a room that we use upstairs. Come to this place and I'll see you Wednesday night about 7 o'clock. So I came there and I went. And I had a session with Gerald. I'll call it a session. It lasted about 2 hours. And what he did was introduce me in 1988 to something which I heard last night was... I laugh because it's 2007, and I'm back in 1988. What did they come? This is out of the National Center for PTSD in Vermont here. It was called at the time, I heard it last night, Prolonged Exposure Therapy. This is supposed to be brand new. It isn't to me because I saw it in 1988. Well, what Gerald and I did was he said, okay, pick an incident that happened to you that really sticks, really hurts you inside. And we'll work on that tonight. So being a real clever guy, experienced combat veteran, tough guy, I picked the one where I was having difficulty with authority. The motivation was that I had entered into a contract with a company. This is present time then. If I got business for this company I was representing, I would get 10% of the gross as compensation for my time. I secured that contract. It was worth $45,000. 10% was 4500 for me. That company got paid. I asked for my commission. They said, well, you did it so fast, it couldn't have been that hard, so we're going to cut it down to $2,500. I told them what they could do with all of the money, which was biological in nature, and lost another job. Well, I told Gerald, I want to work on that. I cannot confront people. It's frightening. And he said, okay, we'll work on that. And we did. And rather than tell you what it was like, I'm going to introduce you today to Victor Volkmann, who helped me edit and publish my memoir. I do so because of several reasons. One, and foremost, it talks about David going through what David went through with Gerald that night. And I'm a little too shy to say that I could talk about myself in an other than present tense. So Victor said, yeah, I understand and I'll read it for you. Second, I told you the TIR is... one-on-one, confidential. So confidential that equal practicing facilitators or viewers or whatever don't even share their client experiences. It's not written down anywhere. It's just, we're going to handle your problem. It's all going to be verbal. And good night. See you tomorrow. See you next week. Never see you again. Glad you're feeling better. However, a fellow named Tom Joyce heard me speak about what I talked with you folks today about in 1989, how this particular therapy helped me where other sources of help failed me. He said, I liked how you presented yourself, but I'd like a lot more detail about what went on. May I interview you about your first session with Gerald French? I said, why? I can tell you whatever you need to know. And he says, well, I'm writing a piece, an article, and I want to include you and your experiences in this thing called Out of the Heart of Darkness or something. I forget the title of his book. I think that was it. And I said, Tom, you're a swell guy. You buy me drinks afterward, and I'll interview with you beforehand. He wrote it down and published it. And it's probably the only one you're going to find out in public for anyone who has been exposed to this particular therapy. Before I ask Victor to come up, I'd like to give you this caveat. I'm trying to be an interventionist. Before traumatic experiences become post or after traumatic experiences and evolve eventually and irrevocably into post-traumatic stress disorder, get help or get your loved one help. I don't own anybody's therapy. What I do own is love and pity. I hope that the pity goes away when they get help and they feel 100% again. Victor, would you be so kind? I'll be back.
Good afternoon, everyone. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to start reading from page 145, and we'll go for two pages. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
So we're starting in the middle of, or at the beginning of David's session, and we'll just go play by play, as it were. David stares down at the table. His eyes are narrowed and his face ruddy, like a man who is exerting an enormous amount of effort to escape from something dark and terrifying that breeds in the murky outback of his mind. Have another look, says the man with the silver beard sitting opposite David. He is big and benign, his features almost elfin. He brings all his presence into the communication, yet remains unobtrusive. David recounts the story for the third time, and there is a perceptible edge to his voice, as if his boredom is curdling into frustration. The district manager and I had this verbal agreement concerning the percentage of sales I would receive, but he decided to rearrange the commission structure before I was paid. We're talking about nearly $7,000 here. Damn it, I earned that money. David breathes deeply and closes his eyes. His square jaw clenches tightly, and when he continues, there's a slight trembling in his voice. I know that I have to confront him, but every time I even think about doing it, my stomach just knots up. David's face flushes with the pigment of rage and humiliation. Here I am, this badass former Marine, black belt martial artist, scared to death over the thought of demanding money that's owed me. I don't know why people always take advantage of me. I don't know why I let them. David stops and swallows hard. He looks up.
angst radiating from icy blue eyes, and shrugs resignedly, signifying that once again he's reached the wall, a barrier beyond which he cannot penetrate. The bearded man nods in genuine empathy. Okay, now let's take a look and tell me if there is another earlier similar incident. David pulls a deep breath into his lungs, closes his eyes, and attempts to pierce that tenebrous cloud of the past, where unspeakable phantasms lurk and disturb the sanctity of sleep. Yeah, there, he says. What do you see right there? Suddenly, David is a 25-year-old lance corporal walking through the bush near Chulai. It is December of 1966, and he is on his 92nd patrol in Vietnam. There is the smell of rain-soaked foliage and warm, redolent earth. It is dusk, and the mosquitoes are beginning to swarm at the smell of human sweat. There are the sounds of jungle life signaling the ingress of night, and above them all, there is the sound of his own heart pumping adrenaline into his veins. He is there, in the grip of saline fear, which has possessed him from the moment his boots touched Vietnamese soil. He has nearly 11 more months of this hell to live through before they will lift his feet out of this green, fetid nightmare. When the sniper fire begins, David is hit in the chest by an AK-47 round. He rolls onto one knee and wields his 3.5 rocket launcher, instinctively aiming toward the outcropping of trees he believes to be the enemy position. He calls for his A-gunner to stand by for loading, but the 18-year-old balks and runs for the nearest cover. David, fuming with anger, rises up. Pain excoriates reason. No emotion survives except rage. As soon as David can reach the tree line, he fully intends to beat the living hell out of the callow grunt who left him with his life on the line. It is all in slow motion now. The loping run toward the trees, the sound of gunfire like popcorn, and the rush of wind as bullets rip past his ears. There is the blood drenching his flak jacket, the numbing in his chest, and the overwhelming anger rising in him with the pressure of an erupting geyser. And now he spots the A-gunner, a solid gray silhouette against the variegated gray of the bush, barely human in appearance, his hands shaking with a spastic intensity of fear. And in those hands is an M14 automatic assault rifle, safety thrown, aimed directly at David's chest. David exhales an expletive, and only then realizes he's been holding his breath for at least 15 seconds. Christ, I just backed off real easy. Like, it's only a flesh wound, man, no problem. I knew if I even looked cross-eyed at this kid, he would blow me away. The bearded man nods, signifying understanding. I got that, he says, and David knows that he has. Go to the start of the incident and tell me when you've done so. David does so three more times. At first, it is painful. Then later on, boring. And then finally, on the fourth recounting, David chuckles to himself. It is a small escape of air, which accompanies a great explosion of clarity. The bearded man nods and queries, "How are you doing?" David looks up, and his eyes sparkle with amusement. "I'm doing fine." His face has relaxed as if some emotional pillory has been lifted from his neck. It's a stupid thing, really. It just occurred to me that not all of the people I have to confront in life are armed and dangerous. I guess it's safe to be upset if you've got a good reason to be. The bearded man returns David's broad smile. It's hard to judge which of them feels a greater sense of accomplishment at this moment. Thanks. We'll end right here. Thank you.
Is this working again? I was a little bit chicken there because I would have cried if I tried to send that. Read it. Thanks so much, Victor. Looking over that, I was struck with the fact that it's not uncommon for post-traumatic stress disorder to, in its ugly little conniving way, hide what's really going on, what the real stressor is. It isn't confrontation about a commission check. It was about being shot to death by a kid that you're depending on. VA wouldn't have found that in me. Traumatic incident reduction found it. Sorry. traumatic incident reduction allowed me to find it on my own. That's not in here. I'm going to give you some highlights, the difference between my experience and the VA experience. They pretty much paralleled each other in many areas, but in the critical areas, they differed greatly. I'm going to be brief, and I'm going to read it. I don't want to miss anything that I remembered and wrote down. TIR is highly structured. The VA group I was in was loose and unstructured. TIR is not done in a group. It's one-on-one. My VA group had 11 members and 2 therapists. In TIR, the patient does all the work. The therapist or counselor offers no interpretations or evaluations. The VA encouraged the opinions of the group, and the therapist added theirs also. In TIR, only one experience is worked on at a time. The VA group included different experiences at each meeting. Sometimes you didn't get to share yours. The TIR session is over when the client, like myself, said, "I'm doing fine now, girl, thank you." It's over when I said it was over. In the VA, it was over at exactly 7:30, if you remember my writing. Total number of traumatic incident reduction hours I spent to get over most of my PTSD symptoms was about 20, maybe 15 sessions. My VA group was still going with 10 members and 2 therapists 16 months after I had joined them. And I was probably worse off than when I started. The VA now has several widely accepted therapeutic treatments. The National Center here in Vermont has done a wonderful academic job of defining and explaining and developing treatments and theories and practices and so on to include, I think now it's called present time counseling. When I was playing with them, it was cognitive behavioral therapy. Fix what's here and now. Don't go back and revisit the real trauma. Get over it and figure out some way to work today. Get your job done. Cognitive behavioral therapy. Exposure therapy. Which, until I heard of prolonged exposure therapy last night, it was in Menlo Park, which at the time, 1986, 87, 88, the VA Mental Health and Rehabilitation Center in Menlo Park was mecca for the nation for treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder. They had a thing called exposure therapy where all of the inpatients, be it 15 to 30, maybe 40, would be gathered in a room much like this, except it was VA and it was all pale green and so on, steel chairs. The new guy would come up, stand before the group, and talk about how hurt he was. Then the group, using Gestalt technique, would attack the position of the new man and invalidate his sensitivity and his feelings and saying, "That's not the here and now," to this poor victim. They were saying, "Forget it. get a job and get on with your life. That's exposure therapy as I know it. Recently, last 6 to 12 months, I heard of something called EMDR. Rapid eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing. It seems that most things have 4 initial acronyms. EMDR. I talked to several people that have recently gone through EMDR work, which they loved. I did so at a retreat for post-traumatic stress disorder casualties that was held in Tucson, Arizona, officiated by the national chaplain who was affiliated with other things to include Vietnam Veterans of America, Phil Salos, Father Phil. They swore that EMDR was the answer. Last night and this morning, reading a printed article, the PA is touting prolonged exposure therapy. And if that doesn't sound like TIR with a new name on it, I'll stand corrected. What they say about, I keep reading it, prolonged exposure therapy is, first of all, the client or the patient is asked to close their eyes. So how does the EMDR work with closing your eyes and prolonged? Well, the only thing that I got from the VA that really worked was meds, medications. They ease or mask the symptoms associated with post-traumatic stress, but it's not a cure. It's a salve. It's a balm. Of the things in the handout that I'd like to call your attention to is this postcard, and more particularly to the back of it. The short story about how this came to be. The Tucson area Marine Moms. The president found my book and read it, bought some more copies to give to the other mothers, and invited me to come to lunch and give them a talk about post-traumatic stress. And particularly because they were having trouble reaching their sons, their daughters, their husbands, or former husbands in some sad cases. They knew there was something wrong. They thought it was post-traumatic stress, but they didn't know what to do. Lisa's frustration all through my present time here. So I developed this. Victor helped me by producing it. And on the back, I came up with some warning signs for traumatic stress. And just as an aside before we go through it quickly, if we do at all. I was fortunate, Lisa saw to Lisa Self, got me an interview with Channel 3, which I did yesterday afternoon. And a fellow named Alex, who's one of the anchors, I think, was talking with me. And he says, a veteran gets a hand or a foot blown off or a leg or bullet shrapnel all through, you can see that. Obviously, he's wounded. But by God, you cannot see PTSD, can you? And I said, funny you should ask. I told the Marine Moms at a lunch not too long ago that we can find you if you're trying to hide PTSD because we can look for some warning signs. The left of the chart says, here's how you can, without even asking, you can pick out whether they're hurting or not. And you can go through them on your own. The thousand-yard stare, sleep disturbances, nightmares, insomnia, and so on. Just found it amusing. So you can run, but you can't hide. You got to get help. Thank you. That's my story. Love to answer any questions I can or deflect the ones I can't. Do we have any to pass forward that was, or a hand raised? Or? Yes, sir. Sherwood.
There are a couple guys that work for me that have recently come back.
Have recently returned?
About a year ago.
Uh-huh.
And they are obvious to me that they have lots of
symptoms are on them. Uh-huh.
They talk to me somewhat, not fully openly, but enough to know that I know they have some of these.
Yes, sir.
And have difficulty dealing with it. But they tell me that I'm not ready to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm available for them. I continue to interact with them to get them to speak privately with me.
Right.
What more can I do?
I would suggest, thank you for that question. I would suggest a couple things. Look at this card. You will find three websites on it. On the front is my book website, but on the back you'll find Traumatic Incident Reduction website, TIR, and you'll find the National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress. I went to their site, and I was quite impressed by how they defined it, how they explain treatments, how to do passive intervention, and so on. I would start there. I would suggest that before you even do that, you make, and this is true of your children, your spouses, whatever, get them fed, get them well rested, get them alone, you and he or she, and say, would you like to talk to me about anything that happened over there? What happened to you? What you saw? Or what you felt? You feel comfortable sharing that with me? Or is that true? Is that true or false? True, but you can't handle what I could tell you. Well, fine. You've admitted to me that you may have a post-traumatic stress problem. Here's the government's resources you can track down and try and find. Call the Veterans Administration Mental Services, Medical Services. If you get a dial tone, if you get a no answer, if you get a answering machine, or however they do it, and you leave your message, and you don't get a call back, don't quit. Go to the vet center. Go to one source. There are places and mechanics out there. My personal experience was that Traumatic Incident Reduction Association provided me the help that I personally needed. But there are other resources. I think the trick to it is, if there's any gadgetry or any magic, the person has to admit it to themselves. That's a hard thing to do when you're tough and you're not scared of anything and you're alive and you're back home and you made it, by God. What'd you come back with? You may be physically fine, but you're a psychologically traumatic casualty. We can't see it, but there are some warning signs. Can you own any of those? And if you can, go get help. You don't have to ever tell me about it, but you owe it to yourself to get better. Does that help you? Good. Thank you. With no further ado, yes, sir. Thank you. I'm going to read it with my glasses. What do you do when the counselors tell you one thing? Hyphen. The servicemen / women tell you they do not want to talk or have contact. Well, as I was mentioning in my answer to Sherwood, see if you can get somehow get them to admit to themselves. They don't have to tell you that they're broken, but you can show them stuff that'll say, if you read this and you identify with it, you may have a problem. I told the Marine moms, don't try to do it yourself, but always make it safe for them and leave scraps of paper that says website 101 PTSD.org. And see, if they're hurting, they'll look for it. Another answer to this nice question. Don't feel that you have to save them yourself. You are not the wife, the father, the mother, the sister, the best friend, the dog, the cat, the closest thing on earth to the person hurt. You don't have to be. You can be an advocate for them. You can go and find these sites and just tell them about it. You want to look? Fine. You don't want to look? Fine. I'm back on the way. Don't think you have to fix them yourself. I think that answered that question. Take a break. Then
you can put up the slides if you want now.
Okay. Thank you all.
Clayton? Clayton works for the state, and he wanted to say a few things to the service members, if there's any here.
Thank you very much, Lisa. Thank you very much, David, for sharing, and Lisa and Kim for organizing today. And since I'm between you and a break, I'm going to keep this awfully quick. Today's focus really has been on the treatment and counseling, and what I'm going to ask is for just a minute or two to shift that focus to the other side of the coin, which is compensation. When there is a veteran who has PTSD or any other condition, whether it's physical or mental, and they are getting care for it, it's also important that they do the proper steps so that the VA recognizes this with disability compensation. And that's where the state can come in to help with that. Does anyone like doing their taxes?
No.
The disability compensation program makes doing your taxes seem like a walk in the park. So if you know anyone, whether for a physical reason, whether for a mental health reason, that they need to work with the VA for a disability compensation claim, let us help you with it. We can act as your representative. And thank you very much.
Who did you say who is it that can help?
Who's going to do the help? Is that the question? That would be the state of Vermont. We're the Office of Veterans Affairs. We're half a block down the street. We have two service officers. We traveled the state, and they're sitting at the back right now, hiding there in the corner. And so, I mean, it's just like if you were going to go to court, you wouldn't go without your lawyer. And so they're the lawyers that can be the advocate for you. And it can be more than just for disability compensation, too, but that's, you know, for today, that seems to be the focus. So thank you very much.
Thank you.